Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Schinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer our information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is when you download it to your iPod or listen on a computer or burn it to a disk, whatever you want to do. Today we have an excellent show. As e-discovery has become a more mature industry, you're beginning to see career paths emerge at law firms for lawyers to develop more expertise and develop more staff resources to throw at electronic discovery matters. It's a new career path and one which offers lawyers the ability to handle e-discovery matters without fumbling the ESI issues or, frankly, opting out of e-discovery because it's foreign to them, even though that's where most of the evidence resides. So this is a new breed of lawyer coming into firms that can enter the field from a number of paths, and today I'm focusing on the associates of electronic discovery, and we have three attorneys who follow different paths into the field and work at firms with different philosophies about electronic discovery. First, representing the fine city of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where I am, Randall Whitlack is a member of the Cincinnati, Ohio-based Dinsmore-Scholes Litigation Department. He practices here in Pittsburgh. As a member of the Mass Torts Practice Group, his practice includes toxic tort, environmental, pharmaceutical, and medical device litigation. These are all areas that encounter lots of e-discovery issues. Additionally, Randall's practice includes healthcare litigation, business torts, and appellate work. He also has experience assisting clients with electronic discovery, records management, and class action litigation. Then from the fine state of New Jersey, which is where I'm from originally, Gina Tremarco is a senior associate in the Business and Financial Services Litigation Group of McCarter & English and is based in Newark, New Jersey. She works with a broad range of commercial, financial, and pharmaceutical clients. Her practice focuses on commercial litigation with a particular concentration on sales practices, breach of contract, suitability, and financial matters. She's experienced in both state and federal court in New York and New Jersey and has handled cases involving two-party disputes, complex class actions, and multi-district, multi-party litigation. Gina also specializes in e-discovery and general litigation management. She has more than 10 years' experience managing discovery projects of all sizes and finding solutions to the challenges that arise. Serves as a principal counsel in charge of all aspects of e-discovery and regularly works with multiple terabyte collections, successfully managing costs and using cutting-edge technology to reduce the volume of documents review. She's also knowledgeable about records management, is advised on records retention program and implementing litigation holds. Great to have you on the show, Gina. And Megan Podolny, You've changed your last name on us. You've been married since the last
show. I got married.
Your original name was easier to pronounce, I got to say. But Megan was very famous on our show for taking on Judge Facciola on privilege logs as a second-year associate, and I'm happy to say she's made it into the third-year associate ranks despite the battle. She's at the AmLaw 100 law firm of Hunt & Williams and focuses on complex commercial litigation matters, including class action defense, securities and fraud litigation, internal investigations, and electronic discovery and data governance issues. In e-discovery, she served as discovery counsel on large-scale internal investigations of financial institutions, as well as in responding to related government subpoenas and civil litigation. She's had a number of good experiences where she's advised the Fortune 500 large financial services company on enterprise-wide preservation activities in response to government subpoenas and related civil litigation, including preservation at hundreds of locations across the country. She led a large-scale pre-merger investigation document collection review for Fortune 500 company for production of documents at the Department of Justice Antitrust Division. She coordinated electronic discovery collection and culling issues and managed large-scale review and deposition preparation related to significant Department of Justice second request for a client in the transportation industry, and lots of other neat experiences. So we've got a really good group here who've waded into e-discovery quite a bit in their backgrounds, and I'm glad to have you all on the show. So why don't I first start off by having each of you tell me how you started in electronic discovery, and if you're comfortable admitting it, are any of you computer geeks? So, Randall, why don't we go in sort of the order I announce people? How about you start off?
Sure. Yeah. I am
I am okay to say that I am not a computer geek by any stretch of the imagination, but I've certainly become more of one since getting involved with electronic discovery, records management. I'm more kind of hip or in tune to what's going on technologically. I started in e-discovery somewhat by chance. A partner at my prior firm, but a partner came into my office late one evening, just before the new the 2006 amendments to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure came out. It was in regard to a huge, relatively huge matter that I was already involved with, an 80,000-person class action toxic tort. We were defending a company where there was, you know, data, frankly, ESI data all over the place, lots of it. This particular partner said, you know, hey, it'd be a good idea for you to learn this thing called e-discovery. I think we're going to have to deal with it. And so I did. You know, I was a first-year associate, and I wasn't going to question it. So I went and I kind of learned it, and thankfully I did, because we literally, in that matter, litigated every issue you could imagine successfully, thankfully, under the amended rules. And some issues we litigated were not in the amended rules, i.e. preservation obligations. And so we really went to battle for a good 4 months out of the case. And from there, it sort of just kind of took off, and I became a resource at that firm, and that continued since I've joined Dinsmore. You know, I'm part of our group here, and we do have an internal group here. And you know, I've become a resource even as a young associate. So that's kind of how I got involved.
Okay, and Gina, how about yourself?
I have to admit, I was a bit of a computer geek. I actually started out managing paper discovery, and made the transition and it started out with a lot of the paper being scanned into the first electronic discovery systems, and then into true collection of real electronic discovery. And I've got to say, a lot of the same principles apply, you know, with the organization and tracking and almost like a chain of custody. But I was, it was a natural fit when it transitioned over and it first started coming out. I was a computer center support person all through college.
Interesting. And Megan?
I was a nerd, but not a computer geek.
a hybrid.
Honestly, you know, other than using email and Microsoft Word to type my law school exams, I really didn't have an experience in computers. But I was hired in as a first-year associate to a team to work for two gentlemen particularly who, that's pretty much their bread and butter was electronic discovery as a cutting front piece over the past 5 years. Before I was hired in. So I was the newbie on the team, and it took me a good 6 months when I first started just reading every resource I could get my hands on, whether it was new case law or articles or work papers from the partners that I was working for on the topic. And about my seventh month into the firm, I basically took a case on by myself from collection all the way through review and production, not necessarily the pleadings works associated with the case, but from a discovery standpoint, I took that in, and I've been, you know, running ever since. So definitely no prior experience, but it just so happened that the team that specifically hired me was looking for somebody who they could use in that role.
Great. Well, let's jump into this. Gina, we'll start with you. Are there any challenges that you see when you're working with other lawyers to help them with e-discovery when you're brought in to support, or are there more challenges when they elect to go at it alone?
I mean, there are definitely more challenges when people go it alone who may not have the experience. One of the most fun things is getting a case from another firm where maybe discovery's gone badly and you have to fix it really quickly. That can be great, but I find that really the continuing challenges, and I don't think it has to do with lack of education, it's just the nature of e-discovery, are the costs and the level of painstaking detail required to collect and really do it properly. And it's just, it never fails to be, you know, somewhat shocking, and sometimes it truly is out of proportion to the matter and things need to be negotiated. So I would say the costs and the levels of details required are always a challenge, and you need to really kind of back up what you're saying, I find. I keep resources around to help do this and keep myself knowledgeable just to, you know, when you're recommending to somebody when they have to do a really painstaking, almost to a forensic level collection situation, it's good to back it up, because people will always say, really? Do I really have to do all that?
And Megan, I think like Gina, your firm has a real e-discovery department approach. And what's the typical way you're brought into a case to help with ESI?
I think there's, you know, two or three typical ways that I usually get dragged in. dragged in may not be the optimal word there, but we have a couple clients where our team serves as their primary e-discovery counsel. So for any case that in-house counsel goes through the early case assessment of, yes, this is a case where discovery is going to be an issue, then usually we are called by the in-house counsel to say, put this case on your list of cases that you're handling the discovery for. And we'll assist with the collection from in-house employees and custodians, but our primary responsibility would be to oversee the processing, review, and production of documents and to assist on 26F conferences. There, it's really nice to come in early when they're doing that early case assessment before they make any statements to the court or the opposing party. I think that's one of the things that scares me the most trend-wise that I'm seeing is not necessarily associates or partners, but just law firms in general or in-house counsel in general making statements about what is and is not possible and what they will and will not do with respect to e-discovery, because there are a lot of easier and more cost-efficient ways to do things that you don't want to be held in violation of an earlier statement. So anyway, that's the first way. And then the second way is we just have a lot of different teams at the firm that have a lot of really good manpower to handle discovery and document reviews, but they don't necessarily have all of their resources available at any one given time. So sometimes we're called in just to provide extra assistance and manpower, and our technical knowledge helps us to kind of lead certain teams within that larger team. Something we have at the firm that we had been talking about earlier before we started the recording was we have a departmental approach where we've trained over 70 attorneys to become somewhat familiar with electronic discovery issues, even if that's not what they do day in and day out. So we have a good channel, and we're always working to make it better, of kind of a line of hierarchy to flag issues in cases where e-discovery really needs to be a concern and need to provide more manpower and assistance with.
Yeah, I think that has to be the way to go, because to have a couple people that are the people that are brought in, the superheroes flown in, I don't want to say demeaning, but the other lawyers that have litigated for years, they would react better, I think, mostly to education, because they've done this for so many years. They don't need a special team. You know, that's the mentality many litigators have. I know how to handle a case. I'm a trial lawyer, damn it.
Right.
but if you give them some education, it's probably less risky. So.
Less risky. I mean, you gain the risk of teaching them enough to be dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what we really try and do, and we're always trying to seek to do better, is give them the education they need to be able to flag the issues, but scare them enough so that they realize that they can't handle everything on their own and they are going to need to go to somebody with expertise to consult, not necessarily to take over the case, but if they can have somebody on their team at an associate level trained on some of these issues to be able to flag concerns,
mm-hmm.
Then that consultation becomes a little bit easier and a little less territorial.
Now, Randall, your firm's approach is a bit different. Much like Chris Fisher did the partner version of the show with where there isn't a clearly defined electronic discovery group on the website, but you have some strong technical people that I know that are called in. So without a clearly defined electronic discovery group per se, how are you brought into a case? Who makes that call?
Well, as you alluded to, we do actually have a formal internal group that everyone can and does draw on, and we certainly have a central knowledge base that is available to everyone, and basically in every matter, and we do have a unique approach, I think, somewhat for a firm our size, at least it's becoming unique, I think. I mean, there are generally going to be one or two attorneys who are fairly deep into e-discovery on just about every matter that whether it requires it or not, these are going to be, people who are certainly familiar with e-discovery, and it just so happens that they get involved in just about every matter. And I think it's unique because with our approach, we don't separate the e-discovery function from the trial team. And so we do our best to integrate those functions, and by doing that, it I think, helps to bridge any knowledge gap between the e-discovery function and the trial team. And, you know, for example, there are a number of people in mass torts, in the mass torts group, who are steeped in e-discovery, and they just end up being staffed on these cases. And we do have an e-discovery and litigation support staff group that tends to work across the board. So it's fairly fluid. Everybody is aware that you know, we exist. So if there is a need for some sort of a consultation or some sort of a you know, if they need to tap into to us either from a legal standpoint or from a more technical standpoint, we're there and we're defined. You know, we're brought in early on. Everybody is educated. Everybody at the firm, and I think recent case law that's been coming out kind of makes it clear that, there needs to be some sort of. I mean, everybody needs to be aware of the issues. You need to know what you need to know in every case, and so, you know, either we're brought in or somebody with e-discovery knowledge is in on the case early, pre-26F. I mean, and there's an understanding there of what needs to be done. I think what's a little bit different here at our firm is, even for our size, we have a broader range of size of litigation. So data demands, you know, certainly differ. And I think what we're good at is we're very good at forming a team with proportionality in mind. And you know, we're really good at that scalability thing. And I think, I think the way that we're structured allows us to develop a capability on a particular matter that is suitable for the size of the case. So.
Okay. And Gina, in your world, do you get to manage your own caseload in addition to handling e-discovery issues, or does e-discovery really completely immerse you?
I do handle my own caseload. It can be pretty challenging at times. It's definitely to different extents depending on how much e-discovery is going on, and hopefully not everything heats up all at the same moment exactly. But it's also something I've brought upon myself, I suppose. I really started out in discovery and then had, I don't know if I ever succeeded into 100% moving into my own caseload, but because I was always being pulled back into everybody, you know, if there was ever a discovery issue, whether management or a dispute, I could never really truly get away from discovery. So at some point, I decided to go with it, really educate myself, especially when it started turning into e-discovery. And I think it's really given me a better perspective for e-discovery. I think my caseload and my argument of motions and pleadings and really seeing the outcomes of things helps me in my own, first, the discovery aspect of my own cases, I find very easy. I mean, maybe not necessarily easy is a good word, but just less of a challenge in that it's just I have such a storage of information and knowledge to go by, that tends to be the least painful part of my case. And then, you know, if somebody's going to start a discovery dispute with me, especially someone trying to use an e-discovery issue as some kind of a sword or shield, or I have my research, I can probably usually argue them out of it on the phone before, like, they're just not getting anywhere with me with that. And I think the perspective is really helpful as far as privilege issues and I'm constantly coming into things where I'll be negotiating with third parties and they'll say things like, oh, well, it's on backup tape, so of course it's inaccessible and there's no way on earth. And it's like, well, you know, how inaccessible is it? It's probably not so inaccessible these days as maybe it was a couple years ago. Is it unique? Is it relevant? Is it, you know, I mean, it gives me such a good perspective on everything, though at times when my caseload is hot, you know, it's hard to be on trial and managing your e-discovery project at the same time. It can be a little, but luckily it's good to be in a firm where you can get other people to cover things for periods of time.
Yeah, that backup tape point is a good point. We did a show with Craig Ball and Quinn Greger and Jim McGann from Index Engines, and we were, you know, all about backup tapes. And one of the dangers, lawyers like black letter law, you know, because then you can grab that and run with it. And unfortunately, in e-discovery, what was you know, a black letter law tenant, like you can't go to backup tapes. You know, of course we're not going there. It's a fishing trip. Now there are ways that you can do it. And it's hard if you're not staying current.
Yep, exactly.
So I
really have to commend you, Gina, for being able to manage that separate workload. I found, and maybe this is because, you know, I'm a much, much newer associate, that I haven't been able to really develop that extra line of work yet because I've been so overwhelmed with e-discovery cases. And you're right, it's kind of like there's a fishing line on your back tugging you back to the next new piece of discovery. And one of the ways that I try and branch out a little bit is, you know, I find for people that are really overwhelmed with e-discovery, pro bono is an excellent way to be able to pick up a single case at a time and not be too overwhelmed, be it, you know, assisting with will drafting. Or a year and a half ago, I had an asylum case, so obviously there was no e-discovery there. But I think that you have been able to create that extra world for yourself is really commendable.
That's an interesting comment there, Megan. Yeah, no, I agree. That's good thought to not be totally overwhelmed or sucked into the field,
mm-hmm.
and then that's where you are in 10 years. Unless it's still around in 10 years, and maybe it's a great thing. Who knows? Randall, what's the dynamic like as an associate when you're brought into a case and you're junior to what has to be many times a partner on a case? You know, are you given domain expertise over technology issues, or does it differ between attorneys?
You know, it varies so much by case. I mean, it really does. I mean, there are tech-savvy partners and there are tech-averse partners. And, you know, the larger the firm, the more diverse, I think, and the more it runs the gamut. You know, I've been involved in cases where, a partner comes and says, look, please manage the legal hold process. A senior attorney or a lawyer must, you know, check or supervise the work, I think. But I've been given pretty wide latitude in regard to managing a lot of things. But then I've also been involved in cases where I have partners who are tech savvy, who get the issues, who will consult me very sparingly. I think the interesting dynamic does come up, because there are certain partners, and not necessarily here, but, you know, I was at another firm before here. But there are oftentimes you'll have somebody who just doesn't see the utility of e-discovery or the necessity. And, I oftentimes it is a tough dynamic, but you have to, you know, often remind some partners that, look, you know, 90% of what we do is created and or stored electronically now. And so if you're not thinking, especially up front, if you're not thinking about e-discovery, where ESI resides, who the key custodians are, if you're not thinking about that, you might find yourself in a predicament. So that's a tougher conversation sometimes, because you don't want to presume that you have more knowledge than a litigator who's been doing this very successfully for, you know, 20, 25 years, 30 years. But, you know, you have to have the conversation. So
you don't want to savage your opportunity to be a partner down the line, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I hate to say it's political, but, I mean, you know, certainly it's a question of tact. Being familiar with these issues, you do have to have that conversation, I think. And, fortunately for me, it's been a successful conversation.
Okay.
Yeah, for me, it's not necessarily the partners as much as it might be the clients. I mean, Randall, you probably have found this as well, but if somebody's going to pull you in as an associate to work on an e-discovery issue, they're pulling you in because they're recognizing that you know more about this one particular issue than they do, and they'll give you a little bit of latitude to do what you need to do as long as you can plan a budget and stay within it. I think the problem comes when, for associates who might be doing what we do that don't have partner backup when it comes to advising clients on what they need to do to fulfill their obligations.
Yeah,
let me turn the question around, and I'm going to ask this to Gina, but it's a hypothetical question, and you can each weigh in. We were talking about this a little before the show. Since e-discovery is an evolving area and the stakes are high if mistakes are made, and importantly, most people recognize one person can't be an expert in all facets. you know, what would you do if you were ever pulled into a situation where you needed more help and you had to educate a more senior lawyer that you aren't the complete Band-Aid to the problem? Maybe a tourniquet is needed. You know, what's the process there, Gina?
I found really that backing up what you're asking for with real, almost like statistical information for why you need it and putting a concrete number on it, such as I've taken samples of data before and taken just like a piece of a sample set of the data, run it through different types of processing, taken different levels of reviewers, you know, just to almost say, okay, this is how much can be done in an hour. If you have this many gigabytes and you take out this, that, or the other thing and do this type of processing, you know, in an early case assessment in 10% and put together almost a whole pricing kind of a model or a like staffing type of a model, and this is what I'm doing for this many hours of the day and this is how much we can get through and this is how much we have to go. So therefore, if it's just me, it's going to take 75 days, you know, versus, you know, times three people. But I try to put together some kind of a concrete model that explains itself of why more help is needed or why it's going to, the additional staffing needs to be paid for or that type of thing.
And Megan, you had a thought on this as well, if it gets really bad.
If it gets really bad, you know, I haven't really encountered too many of the same issues that Gina has with respect to staffing, but more hearing through the grapevine that a certain team may want to be handling discovery in a way that doesn't really accord to best practices that we've instilled at the firm. And what we have here is a really good general counsel's office that has taken upon it themselves the mission to educate as many people as possible in the firm about the risks of trying to handle e-discovery solo or not relying on the little mini experts we've created within the firm. So I think that if you encounter any difficulty in getting a partner or a more senior associate on board with what you have thought would be the best way to handle e-discovery issues, particularly if it has to do with preservation or, you know, when it gets down to the pleadings standpoint, go to your general counsel's office, because there's no general counsel at a qualified firm that would not realize this is an issue that really needs to be paid attention to.
Yeah, if it hits all the partners' pockets, it gets everyone's attention. So, to sort of finish out a point you raised earlier, Megan, about pro bono work, changing the question a little bit. Do you believe an associate should focus completely on electronic discovery, or do you think also as part of your career path developing that it makes sense to develop a substantive area of expertise as well?
Right. I think right now we're kind of in a golden age. You know, I think right now it's fine for an associate to plan on it and be able to have enough e-discovery work to keep their plates full for the next year or two, but And let's face it, you know, people like me were new, were really, really cheap comparatively to what other people could be costing their clients and their teams. But you're right, I think pretty soon there are going to be enough people in law firms or in-house that are going to be familiar enough with these topics to think that they can do it themselves and to handle it themselves, and they may be fine. I think the risk is jumping to that phase too quickly. So I think that if more senior attorneys, right now there's an indifference to really being able to focus on these issues and learn what they need to learn to be able to handle it on their own and within their internal teams. And if that indifference ever dissipates, then yes, I think there will be a dearth of work that associates need to start developing a new line of expertise and work. I think that e-discovery is really unique, though, that it lends itself well to blending with other fields to make yourself a better commodity. And it definitely lends itself well to any type of records management practice, which every client across the company will want to adjust their records management practices and have, you know, a law firm buy into whatever they want to have as their official records management practice. So I think over the next few years, associates who are specializing in e-discovery really need to be able to learn how to market their services into some sort of blended practice.
And actually, Randall came up with this term. We were talking about it a couple days ago about the podcast. But since, Gina, since you came in before the golden age when it was paper and involved in e-discovery, do you believe electronic discovery is like ERISA, You know, when ERISA was passed for an associate, it's the area which was new when it came out, and there was little expertise at the top in many firms. Do you think that's sort of an accurate description right now?
No. I mean, just from going to Sedona conferences and seeing it at my own firm, I think there are people at all levels who have sort of made it their business to become really knowledgeable about this. But I think it kind of takes a certain type, especially with respect to people who were already successful and didn't necessarily have any particular need to get involved in this area. I suspect they might have been closet computer geeks at some point in their lives and just had an interest in technology. But, you know, if you look at some of the people who are at the forefront of this, they're people who are at the top, for sure.
Yeah, you know what? This is almost, you know, I almost think if I had one more panelist, I'd like to have someone from a 30 or 40 person law firm, you know, because I think in that scenario, from the friends I have, they only go one deep in this area. So maybe it's maturing at the larger firms, but they're still, you know, interesting, real interesting opportunities at mid-sized firms.
Can I actually, Carl, sorry.
Go ahead.
Can I just actually say something about that? What I've noticed is, as I think that's a great point. I mean, I think that middle market companies, smaller companies, technology is becoming more and more available. This is just my opinion. I think, 10 years ago or whatever, technology, you know, enterprise-wide email, et cetera, was more of a larger company thing. But I think, you know, technology is becoming so available now to mid-size companies, smaller companies, that mid-size firms, smaller firms, frankly, may have an opportunity there that larger firms might not have that same opportunity. And I don't know if that goes to your point. I think it does. But also, could I comment, too, on something Megan said earlier? You had asked a question about a dearth of e-discovery work, and should you be diversifying, I guess, or branching out into a more substantive area or developing an expertise there. Something that I've seen in terms of a dearth of work over the next 5-10 years is I'm seeing clients internalizing a lot of these processes, especially larger clients.
Exactly. Yeah.
And not just internalization, they're asking me about routinization. In other words, can you help us to develop a scalable, repeatable, defensible e-discovery response plan, legal hold plan that we can implement every time? And you know, I generally think that's a good thing, you know, particularly if you, you know, think about the Sedona principles and you think about, you know, what the rules mean. I think that's a good approach, but as you see that happening, as they're internalizing this, routinizing it, it might not be as time intensive in the future. And that's not to say, you know, maybe it will, but it may not be.
With respect to the in-house, moving everything in-house, that's something I've definitely seen over this past year, and not only gradually moving things in-house, but asking us to advise them on how they can bring some of the processes we offer to them now.
Yeah.
So that they can handle it themselves. And, you know, that's something that scares me a little, not necessarily because it means less work for Megan and Hunton, but because I think there's something to be said for having a law firm handle that aspect of discovery to make it a little bit more defensible than if you were to bring all of that in-house, to add that extra layer of protection that you can rely on law firms who are – This is their bread and butter. This is their mainstay of providing to clients. Be the ones to provide those services that you can rely on, rather than having to defend yourself as a company on your own discovery practices.
Yeah. The other danger I see from that is it's not like we've solved it yet. So what are you standardizing on? You may standardize on a system that in a year or two is completely a dog system. You know, there are so many things that are happening right now. You know, the space I'm in is a good example of concept searching. You know, if you're not looking at those types of processes and you go with more of a straight hosting type of a tool with linear review, what have you got?
Yeah.
You know, you've got a labor-intensive process. And that's just one example. The backup tape example is another good example. I mean, technology is changing. You know, we get the cloud. You know, the business processes are changing. So it's real hard to standardize, but it's a good dialogue to have because it's expensive. So
yeah.
It's a dialogue is what I say. But But I think the firms have to be involved because of the experimentation.
Well, also because, you know, if there's any clients that are going to be listening to this podcast, it's with respective vendors. I found that sometimes clients have a preferred vendor that they will just not cut the tie with, regardless of how expensive or completely inefficient their tool might be. And when you have a law firm handling that aspect of discovery, not only do law firms tend not to play favorites with vendors, they will market one vendor against another, test them out, see how they can get the better pricing for their clients for a particular case, but they also can take advantage of volume pricing, particularly if you're a larger firm who's sending a lot of work to a particular client, and that serves the client better in the end.
Yep. Well, go ahead.
I was just going to say, like any other good business process, you know, it's, you can standardize it, but you always have to continue to look at it and let it evolve over the years. You know, times do change, and so should your standard process to keep up with them.
Yeah.
Yeah, total quality management from the 90s. But anyway, so let's talk about the next generation of associates that are coming in. I did a really neat podcast with Judge Grimm where we interviewed 8 law students who've each taken 300 hours of e-discovery. And then there are people that come in, that, such as Megan, that are just, you know, hired into a slot because there's a need for resources. Does there become a pecking order, or is this no different from any other area of law? You know, is there a mentoring approach? I'd like to also ask this to Megan, since you're in a formal department, which probably identifies unique hiring needs each year. But let's start with you, Rand. What do you think? How's that going to evolve?
Well,
or is it just a bad question? It might be.
I don't think it's a bad question. I think it's a great question because, you know, I think that, you know, in every practice area, practice group, you need to, I think there needs to be some succession planning. There needs to be even, you know, even as a young associate, you know, you think about that, who's going to be next and who's going to help me as I move along, you know, frankly, at a lower rate. You know, I think at our firm, because it's not as rigid, you know, there's not as rigid, you know, group sort of thing. I think it's more fluid. I mean, what happens is, you know, new associates come in because of their practice area, and this goes kind of back to how we do things. I mean, you know, the e-discovery function not separate from the trial function. I think depending on the practice area, they necessarily move into kind of like the e-discovery path, if you will, and the records management path, and you know, they're just identified early on by interest, by aptitude, I would think, and it's certainly not, at least that I'm aware of, and you know, there's certainly not some sort of a rigid, well, geez, we need X amount of e-discovery associates this year, sort of thing. It's more of a fluid, organic process. I don't know if that's a nice way to say, yeah, who knows, but I think it's just more organic, and it depends on practice area. Here, anyway.
How about you, Megan, in your rigid department?
Yeah, I think that Randall's answer is actually really good. One of the things as a young associate I have the hardest time, you know, wrapping my head around is the way that law firms tend to hire new associates that are out of law school, and the way they have to plan so far in advance to have that next replacement just boggles my mind as being really inefficient. But I guess there's really no way around it. We haven't really hired anybody new particularly into the team from a brand new associate perspective since I started, but I've only been here 3 years, so ask me that question again in 2 years and we'll see if I have a better answer. But as a group, at least, we tend to mentor all attorneys across the firm on these issues, not just ones that are new and coming in. I mean, we develop CLEs for new associates coming into the firm to become aware of these issues, and if someone sparks some interest in it, then we try and see if we can kind of tap them to come and help us as a resource on some of our e-discovery issues as a supplement, but not necessarily part of the internal core team. So we do a lot of CLEs to just kind of mentor people and be that resource for them. But I don't think we've really developed a way of hiring in new talent as of yet, particularly because, you know, we do have kind of a formal department for e-discovery, but it's not a department, as in a team that has its own budget to be able to hire new people. It is, you know, we belong to a different litigation team, and we just have a specialized group of people. It's not that we have our own ability to add extra headcount, particularly for this team. They'd have to be accepted by the larger litigation team, if that makes sense.
You know what? You raised the point. I'm going to throw it out here. I hope their partner's listening to this, because I'm not in this game anymore, this business model. But I agree with you 100% that it's a challenge, especially when you're looking at technical slots, to plan from a summer associate hiring approach 18 months out, whatever, you know, who's going to be filling what slots. And I've always thought it made sense to hire from the law schools like first-round draft picks, but use contractors as your second, your free agent hiring, you know, whatever you want to look, if you look at football analogies. And but you know, a little differently, because you can find technical skills when you need them and try them out. But I've, you know, as someone that used to own a large staffing company, have always been surprised that most contractors have been cannon fodder for the reviews. And you know, there's almost a lack of it's almost like going to the dog pound to get a dog, okay? You know, oh, I don't want that used dog, whatever type of mentality. I need to grow my own. But, you know, lots of people, you know, get animals from the shelters, and they have great pets, and they turn into wonderful, adoring, you know, it's not getting something off the trash heap at all.
Yeah.
It's reintegrating and finding a skill set when you need it.
Yeah, I mean, since I've been here, the last three people that have sort of been added to the team have all been lateral hires.
And that's the other way of doing it, too.
Yeah, people who, you know, the partners that work on our team have experience working with before on other projects that before they came to the firm and said, hey, if you are ever looking for an opportunity, let me know. And so they were laterally hired in, and they do a fantastic job. But at the same time, you know, those are people that are of my level or higher, and it sure would be nice to have somebody that I could take that one-on-one time to mentor. Just hasn't had the opportunity yet.
Okay, well, now let's look sort of at the future here. Gina, do you think we're going to get to a day soon when lawyers everywhere have enough competence to handle ESI just like they handled paper for years? And if so, what do you and the rest of the lawyers in the panel do? I guess you have another practice you work in.
You know, and honestly, for everybody should really, as far as marketability and future, and no matter what your practice area, it can ebb and flow. So you should try to branch out a little bit and always volunteer for other things. You know, if you're a litigator, it's not like you have to litigate only one type of law. You can, you know, help people with their depositions and something else. But I think there will always remain enough work for there to be a practice group, because I think even though, just like regular discovery management, there will always be big enough managers that discovery, the whole discovery component of it, could use its own little team or at least a person to be in charge of it. And it's just not in everyone's nature to want to deal with that. Just like when it was paper discovery, I think there were often cases that were with a complicated enough discovery situation where you wanted somebody who was truly an expert in that to deal with that. Because you can't, you know, be an expert in everything all the time, always.
Okay, well, I'd like to ask each of you, and then start with Randall, then Megan, and then Eugenia. Do you have any advice for attorneys who have technical backgrounds or interest in electronic discovery and how to develop this practice?
Yeah, I mean, I think I have a couple of things, and this is so simple that I hesitate to even say it, but get out there. Everybody's situation is different. I mean, large firms have budgets to get associates out there, and it varies from firm to firm, but you may have to spend your own money. I mean, if you're not getting into the working group, go to the DONA conference, getting ahead of the eDiscovery Curve program. Go get out there, mingle. Do speaking engagements. Publish as much as you can. Go outside your firm. More importantly, at least from my perspective, because, again, I was not a computer geek, and I did not have a technical background, in college or anything, learn the technology. I mean, really, and that might be, non-billable personal time, but, learn it. on your free time, understand what it is you're dealing with. Understand media. Understand information systems. Understand understand the animal that you're trying to wrestle, and let people know in your firm. I mean, let people know in your firm, outside your firm. You know, e-discovery case updates works well. I think that developing a brand and marketing yourself as somebody who understands this stuff and actually understanding it is just all you can do. That's my opinion.
Anything you want to add, Megan and or
yeah,
Gina?
Yeah, I think it's kind of cyclical, actually. I mean, if you have the technical knowledge and the technical know-how, and you're able to display it on one case, I think my best advice to you is to be a sponge on the non-technical pieces as well. You become a little mini expert on whatever case you're dealing with, whatever issues are going on in that case. So not only can you prove your ability on that one case, but you also become knowledgeable about another subject matter. So that provides you two new avenues of work to work on. I think being a sponge is probably the best advice I can possibly give to anybody, because it provides the opportunity for more work. More work is definitely a cyclical nature whenever you get more knowledge about something. And I think the other piece of it is to figure out what the client needs are for the clients that your company is working with. And because there may be more, you know, as we get more types of forms of communication and technology, there's not only more widespread use of it, but the different types of it also expand pretty rapidly. And if you figure out what types of technology your client is dealing with and what types of data extraction issues your client is dealing with, and you become the mini expert on that issue, it makes your team a lot more marketable and a better commodity than another law firm with somebody else's technical expert know-how, because you've taken the time to figure out what your client's needs actually are.
Okay. I'm not sure if that's all options out there. If you don't have anything to add, Gina, I'll give you the last question.
I could add one little thing to all of those great answers, and it's really just building upon what Megan and Randall were saying. And I would just say, there are so many organizations you can join, like Sedona. Volunteer, contact the people in charge, and offer to write or speak or do something for them. Because they'll probably take you up on it, and then it'll force you in your busy schedule to find time to do this and stay on top of things. And Lexis and Westlaw both have a free case updating service. You can have a search that runs every single week and gives you back the new e-discovery cases. Pick one and send an update to your practice group or the people you work with. Summarize, you know, the most important one of the week or the month or whatever. And it's a way to kind of get your name out there, and maybe somebody will think of calling you when they have an e-discovery case or issue.
Yeah, I've set up a Google. I mean, you can set up Google searches. You know, I track concept searching and a couple of other fields. I track myself. I can know what people are saying, what's coming up on me online. So, but you know, anyway, that's a whole different problem. outside of listening to ESI Bytes, what do you do to stay current in e-discovery? And you may not listen to ESI Bytes. I just threw that in there. It's fine. we're getting the downloads from somewhere. But are there other areas that you're looking at? You mentioned Sedona, Gina. I'm trying to think of. I mean, I know EDRM. I'm involved with them. They're a good source. Any other nuggets?
I think if you take it upon yourself to be the training person for your firm, and it comes down to you putting together CLEs for other associates and attorneys in your firm to become knowledgeable about some of these issues. Of course, you have to stay updated with the current case law so that you're providing the best continuing legal education you can. So we do that pretty frequently to stay abreast of what's going on. And the other thing is, you know, a lot of the state bars are coming out with their own independent subcommittees on e-discovery. DC just came out with theirs about a year ago. And so having the ability to network with other attorneys in the same city where you're practicing that are also interested in these issues, and you're able to put together different programs for the surrounding city, is also a really good way to stay not only knowledgeable, but connected and involved into the area where you're practicing.
Great. All right. Well, I think we've covered this topic well. I appreciate having you all join us here, Gina, Randall, Megan, really has been good. I hope we'll get another chance to have you on future shows. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com for a complete list of our show. You can also remember our show and website phonetically. It's Easy Bytes if you sounded out the domain name. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Schinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Jurnov, wishing you a nice day.